If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. When did people first realise that Everest was the world's highest mountain? Did Mallory really try and climb it just because it was there? And how did an Everest expedition spark a diplomatic crisis known as the Affair of the Dancing Llamas? Tomorrow marks the 70th anniversary of Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay's famous first summit. So to mark the occasion, Dr. Jonathan Westaway answers these questions and more in conversation with David Musgrove in this Everything You Want to Know episode on the history of mountaineering on Everest.
Jonathan, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. The first question, the basic one, is where is Everest and how high is it?
Everest is situated on the international border between Tibet, China, and Nepal. So it's in the kind of eastern Himalaya range. So if you looked at a global map, you know, you'd have India to the south, China and Tibet to the north, and it's in that kind of border mountain range, which is, of course, the highest mountain range in the world. In terms of how high it is, well, lots of people have come up with different figures, but the current accepted figure, which was agreed by the Chinese and Nepalese surveyors in 2020, is that it's 8,848.86 meters, which in old money is 29,031.9 feet. There was some controversy in the last few decades. You know, the Nepalese surveyed the snow height, the Chinese surveyed the rock height, but they've eventually agreed. And that figure pretty much matches the surveyed height from 1852, really, within tens of feet. So we've known of the height of Mount Everest. We've known that it's the highest mountain in the world since the middle of the 19th century.
Well, let's just jump onto that then, actually, because we've got a question from Holly Dolly Doodar, who wanted to know, when was it actually surveyed and measured? And she sort of followed up with, when did the West become aware of Everest being the highest peak?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it was surveyed from Darjeeling by the Survey of India when India was part of the British Empire. It was originally called Peak Gamma, and then they changed that to Peak B in 1847, and eventually it became Peak 15. Nobody had ever been close to Everest at the time, no Western surveyors. Anyway, of course, there were people living around Everest. So it took quite a while to work out that it was the highest mountain in the world. I think eventually there was an Indian surveyor whose name, he was called a computer in the Survey of India, and his name was Radhanath Sikdar, and he worked out, I think, in 1852 that actually Everest was higher than Kanchenjunga, and it was actually the highest mountain in the world. But it took a long time before people got close to Everest to survey it in more detail.
So that's pretty incredible surveying work from the mid-19th century to get so close to the figure that we've got today then.
Absolutely, yeah. Sikdar was an expert in spherical trigonometry, you know, the trigonometry of the globe, basically. He was a very accomplished mathematician. He was a good friend with the Surveyor General, and he was critical in determining that Everest, was actually the highest mountain in the world.
Mm-hmm. So one of the most popular search engine questions on the topic is why it is actually called Mount Everest, and it sort of follows up with what other names does it go by? You've mentioned a couple of names that were sort of at the start of the surveying process, but what is the origin of Everest itself?
So it was named by Andrew Waugh, who was the head of the Survey of India in the middle of the 19th century, after his predecessor, Sir George Everest, and he actually pronounced his surname Everest. So we've been pronouncing it incorrectly ever since. And it was decided to honour the previous Surveyor General by naming the mountain after him. But of course, it does have other names. At the time, they knew that it had a Tibetan name, Chomolungma. And there are other names as well.
Regular podcast listener Greg Buckle has asked, did local people scale Everest before Europeans?
That's an interesting question. There's no evidence that they did. And when you look at the sheer amount of resource, technology and effort it took to get two people to the summit by 1953, you'll realise what a prodigious task it would have been. I think there are other places in the world where there were people climbing to quite high altitude. So if you look at South America, you know, we know the Inca were performing religious rites up to 20, 22,000 feet, but the mountains there are quite different. You know, they're low-angled volcanic cones, the weather conditions are quite stable. So it's a completely different environment. And, you know, you've got another 8,000-9,000 feet to go in the Himalayas. So it seems extremely unlikely. Most of the people living around the mountain were living at subsistence levels in the Solukhumbu in Nepal or in the Tibetan provinces to the north. And they simply had no need to go to the summit. And, you know, it would have been extremely challenging, you know, before the advent of modern technology. So, and also, of course, you've got to bear in mind that the summit of the mountain has spiritual connotations for local Tibetan groups. It was believed, the name Chomolungma is believed to have originated and derived from the name of a long life goddess whose name was Myolang Sangma, which means the immovable lovely lady of the alpine willows. And there's some really interesting research being done at the moment by Ruth Gamble at La Trobe University in Australia about this and about how this notion that the mountain is inhabited by a deity is still adhered to by groups around the mountain.
You've stepped into the next question from Steph McVank, who wants to know, when did interest in climbing Everest really first begin, and what was it first born out of? So do you want to go into a little bit more detail on that one?
Yeah, sure. So really, I think we have to think about the start of the 20th century and various explorers like Sir Francis Younghusband had traversed Asia and crossed over the Karakoram Range, and he'd seen Everest from a distance, and he talked to Lord Curzon, who was the Viceroy of India early in the century, and they'd had discussions about whether it would be possible to climb Everest. John Noel, who is a mountaineer who went on the early Everest expeditions, had got within, I think, 40 miles of Everest in 1913, and he was very keen on promoting the idea of climbing Everest to the Royal Geographical Society back in London. But then the First World War broke out, and the idea was picked up again in about 1919. And then the Royal Geographical Society and the Alpine Club put together a kind of Mount Everest committee to look at the possibility of climbing Everest. And they sent the first reconnaissance expedition to Everest in 1921 under Charles Howard Bury.
Well, that leads us into the next question, which is a bit of a leading question from Nick Lloyd, who's a First World War historian. He wants to know, who were the first climbers to reach the summit of Mount Everest, and specifically, did Mallory make it? So you'd better just tell us who Mallory is and where that expedition fits into the story.
So the first people, verified people to reach the summit were Ed Hillary and Tenzing Norgay in 1953. Big open question is, did George Mallory and Sandy Irvine, you know, reach the summit in 1924? I suspect we will never know. You know, a huge amount of ink has been spilt discussing exactly whether they could have, which way the evidence points to. Mallory's body was found in the late 90s on the north face, you know, below some of the rock steps on the northeast ridge. And people have tried to piece together, you know, various scenarios. The bottom line is, you know, we don't know. There has been a lot of discussion around what happened to Mallory's camera. He took Somerville's camera to the summit with him. People have wondered if we could find the camera. And the film was still there and it could be preserved and exposed. Would it provide proof that they reached the summit? Who knows? You know, whether we'll ever find that camera. But at the moment, that's all, you know, it's unproven whether they reached the summit. Could they have reached the summit? You know, were they physically capable? Did they have the technology to do it? Did they have the ability? Mallory was a superb rock climber. Sandy Irvine was a very fit athlete. But the objective hazards, challenges at that altitude, they're not insignificant. They would have had to have done some pretty serious rock climbing at very high altitude. And even if they got to the summit, looking at the timescales they were working on the 8th of June 1924, they may not have had enough time to get back down, you know, in reasonable time. They may have had an accident on the way back down. But the bottom line is, we just don't know.
Well, that takes us on to a good question from KT, who asks, why was there such a big gap between Mallory and Hillary? She wants to know whether people were spooked. So it's about 30 years, isn't it, between those two expeditions?
Yeah, the straightforward answer is that the Tibetans banned any further expeditions after 1924 for 10 years because they were extremely cross about something that happened after the expedition. So John Knoll, who had the rights to film on Everest, and he made a film called The Epic of Everest, and he toured it around the UK and around Europe and around North America, also brought back with him some what he called lamas. They were some Tibetan monks. They did not have permission from their monastic orders to leave Tibet or from the government of Tibet. And they performed a kind of vaudeville show in theatres to provide a context for the film, because Noel was concerned there was lots of stuff missing from his film, local colour, he didn't have shots high up on the mountain. So he tried to create this kind of Everest spectacle. And it was extremely lucrative for him, and he was in partnership with the Royal Geographical Society and the Alpine Club, and they formed a company. But the Tibetan government was absolutely incensed because they thought their portrayal of Tibetan religious culture was insensitive. You know, it wasn't authorized. It wasn't a real religious ritual. You know, the monks didn't have permission, and it caused a diplomatic incident which really affected diplomatic relations between British India and Tibet. So it took a lot of work by the British political agent in Sikkim, Bhutan, and Tibet over the next 10 years to gain permission for the next expedition, which was in 1933. There's a great paper on it by Professor Peter Hansen, and it's generally referred to as the Affair of the Dancing Lamas. So, you know, you can look it up on Wikipedia or you can find Peter's article. But yeah, extraordinary. And it was covered up for a long time. You know, it was the British establishment came up with a kind of a cover story to save face, but it eventually all came out into the open, really, when Walt Unsworth published his book on Everest in the 1980s.
Wow. And so The Affair of the Dancing Llamas, that's a fascinating title. So did these llamas have an impact in Britain? Did they make quite a ripple in society? Presumably they did.
Yeah, they were, these Tibetans were kind of on tour around the UK and Europe. The company that they set up to manage this eventually went bankrupt when the monks were going back to Tibet, and they were stranded in Colombo, and they had to kind of raise funds to repatriate the monks. And then when the monks returned to Tibet, they were severely kind of reprimanded and punished by their orders, because it caused an enormous amount of trouble for the Tibetan government.
Okay, so then there was another expedition in the 1930s, once that diplomatic incident has subsided a bit, and then I guess Second World War probably puts a bit of a halt to anything further for a while. Were there any other big expeditions between the 20s and 1953?
Yeah, there were loads. So there was one in 1933, there was a 1935 reconnaissance, one in 1936, one in 1938. And then post-war, things kick off again in 1950. There was a reconnaissance in 1951. The Swiss attempted Everest in 1952. And then 1953, you have the successful ascent.
Okay, so a lot of lead up there then to 1953. The big search engine question is, why did the 1953 expedition succeed?
I think they'd learnt an enormous amount over all these previous failed expeditions. I think it's generally accepted that the logistics in 1953, managed by John Hunt, were exceptional. Hunt had a military background, and he knew that he had to rotate people up through camps, and he had to keep them provisioned. There was a lot of work by a physiologist called Pugh, I think, who really looked at particularly hydration and feeding at altitude, and looked at the body as a kind of machine that needed fueling. So he worked very closely on designing equipment and efficient stoves and things like this. And they'd perfected oxygen apparatus as well. You know, they had a lot of high altitude experience during the war with bomber crews needing oxygen equipment, and oxygen equipment had just become better. So you put all those things together, those kind of 20, 30 years of trying and failing, learning what works, you know, new equipment, and that all went to contribute to the success.
So there was a question from James Witts, who wanted to know, was there any tech of the age that helped the likes of Sir Edmund Hillary acclimatise to such extreme altitudes at much lower levels? You've sort of just alluded to some things there. Presumably there was quite an effort to make sure that there was tech to back up what they were doing.
They were physically monitored a lot more carefully and treated more like athletes, you know, than previous expeditions. You know, some of the expeditions of the 30s had taken a radically different approach. The Eric Shipton, who famously pioneered a kind of a very lightweight approach to mountaineering on some of his expeditions to Everest, they had minimal food, you know, and consequently, you know, they just weren't being powered properly to work at altitude. So Hunt's approach was completely different, and it was run more like a military operation rather than a, you know, kind of amateur mountaineering endeavor. So, and it paid off.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
So one of the most popular questions, and there's one MHFQ on Twitter asked it, but numerous people did, was what equipment was used in the first attempts. You kind of imagine that there's poor souls trying to hike up the mountain wearing hobnail boots and wearing leather breeches and stuff like that. How basic was some of the kit, and how advanced did it get in the run up to 53?
Well, certainly in those 20s expeditions, the clothing, you know, was effective, but it wasn't much different from clothes people would wear on the hills in the UK. Wool layers, tweed. Certainly in 1924, they started using Grenfell cloth, which was manufactured starting in 1923, and it was commissioned by Sir Wilfrid Grenfell, who was running mission hospitals in Labrador, and he needed a windproof, kind of waterproof cotton ventile cloth that could keep people, you know, warm and dry in extreme environments. So there was a company, I think it was in Blackburn in Lancashire, that made the cloth. And in 1924, they took Grenfell cloth they made windproof garments out of that on Everest, and they had them for their high altitude Sherpa porters as well. So George Ingall Finch, who was an Australian member of the expedition, he also made his own down jackets as well. So he was really innovating at the time, you know, and he knew the importance of keeping warm. So there was some kind of technical innovation around clothing. And of course, they experimented with oxygen apparatus as well. It was still at a very early stage, but I suppose, you know, the biggest technical innovation in the 20s was the use of oxygen. And they were, you know, conflicted over whether it should be used. But by 1924, you know, Mallory, who was originally quite hostile to the idea of using oxygen, was totally convinced that the mountain wouldn't be climbed without oxygen. And when they set off on you know, when Mallory and Irvin set off on the 8th of June, 1924, you know, they were using oxygen equipment.
So, but what was the global impact of the 1953 expedition? How far did the story of the expedition spread around the world, and what impact did it have?
Yeah, it was a global phenomenon. You know, at the time, people had long characterized Everest as the third pole, and it was very much seen as the last of those great romantic, heroic quests to conquer the extremes of the planet. It made Tenzing Norgay an international superstar. You know, he'd come from very humble beginnings. He was born Carter in Tibet, and his family moved into the Solo Kumbu in Nepal. You know, he'd had a long career supporting expeditions as a high altitude worker in the 1930s, 1940s. And then suddenly he's catapulted onto the world stage. You know, India embraces him, and he ends up being part of India's mountaineering training center. So, you know, Ed Hillary, you know, went on to create some amazing foundations and charities that helped develop the region. And of course, it triggered a whole new wave of interest in climbing Everest from, you know, people all around the world wanted to be associated with climbing Everest and linking, you know, their kind of endeavors with the highest mountain in the world. And it became a kind of global signifier of success and prestige. And it becomes what it is today, you know, part of a kind of adventure tourism mecca where hundreds of people are climbing the mountain every year and living out their kind of dreams and visions through being associated with the summit of Everest.
So once Everest had been summited in 53, that didn't in any way put a stop to the need to get to the top. In fact, it just encouraged people to want to do more and approach it differently, I suppose, and look at things like climbing without oxygen and that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there were still lots of nationalist imperatives to climb the mountain. So the Swiss climbed it in 1956. The Chinese climbed it in 1960 from the north, the first time the mountain had been climbed from the north. And that was, you know, that was quite a global event as well. It was really important for, you know, the Chinese Communist Party. The United States climbed in 1963. There was an amazing traverse, you know, that the Americans did of the West Ridge over the summit and down the South Col, which some people still think is, you know, one of the greatest mountaineering achievements of all time. And it just goes on and on. 1975, Yuko Tabei from Japan was the first woman to summit Everest. And now, you know, kind of everybody's chasing records, you know, to be the first person from their country or the youngest person from their country. You know, it's become a global signifier of prestige.
We'll come on to women on the summit in a second. We had a question about that. But I just want to go back to the role of Sherpas. So we've got a question about what is the role of Sherpas and other local people in mountaineering on Mount Everest. And you sort of talked about how Tenzing Norgay became, like, you know, the global celebrity, maybe the figurehead for that community in a way, perhaps. But they've got a crucial role in this story.
We generally tend to refer to high altitude workers on Everest and other Himalayan mountains as Sherpas. Now, that's a kind of labor category. And actually, as an ethnic category, Sherpas are, you know, a kind of Buddhist Tibetan people who live in the Solo Khumbu south of Everest. But there are lots of other ethnic groups involved in labor on the mountain. You know, Nepal is a very ethnically complex, diverse place. And quite often what happens at the moment is Western clients want to have an interaction with Sherpas. So lots of these other ethnic groups pass as Sherpas on the mountains. They say, yeah, sure, we're Sherpas, you know, but they might be Gurung or Rai or Limbu or, you know. So there's an interesting kind of hidden ethnic complexity to labor on the mountain today. But yeah, these expeditions required huge amounts of labor. 20s and 30s expeditions would have recruited labor in Darjeeling from, you know, Nepalese groups and other Sikkimese groups. When they got to Tibet, they would have recruited local Tibetans to help carry stuff as well. And, you know, by 1924, the British had developed this idea that Sherpas from the Solu Khumbu, ethnic Sherpas, were particularly well adapted to high altitude mountaineering work. And they developed this kind of mystique around the Sherpas as a kind of mountain race, which really echoed what they'd done with the Gurkhas from Nepal, who they developed this kind of notion as a martial race that they'd co-opted into the kind of imperial rule in British India. So, yeah, indigenous high altitude labor is absolutely critical to the success of all these expeditions. And a point that Nims Purja made in his recent film about his 9-month ascent of all the 8,000 meter peaks, you know, he did it to highlight the contribution of Nepalese mountaineers. You know, if you look at the number of people who've climbed Everest and climbed Everest multiple times, you know, the first 30 names on the list are Nepalese. And even in the 1930s, there were high altitude guides and mountaineers, Nepalese, who had way more experience than any Western mountaineers. But we know next to nothing about them because they were illiterate. They were written out of Western histories of mountaineering. I'm currently part of a research project called Other Everests, and we're trying to research the hidden histories of indigenous high-altitude workers, you know, Sherpas and porters from the 1920s, 30s and 40s.
Let's go back to women for a second, because Prachi Chitri asked who was the first woman to summit Mount Everest, and also asked how many women have climbed Everest to date. So you already gave an answer to the first section, but I suppose it kind of begs a bigger question about how far women have been involved in the story of mountaineering on Everest, how far they've been allowed to be involved, I suppose, in the early expeditions. What's your take on that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Certainly those early 1920s expeditions did employ some female Tibetan porters. We've got photographs of them, you know, in the Royal Geographical Society archives. But of course, these were, was a male world. You know, women were excluded from exploration. You know, I've come across one letter of a woman who applied to go on one of the expeditions in the 1930s to Everest. But, you know, it was a male club. You know, it was very elitist and exclusive, and it replicated the values of its time. You know, so it was patriarchal, it was misogynistic, and there wasn't any room for women in expeditions like this. So in terms of the number of women who've climbed the mountain, I think as of January 2023, the Himalayan database records, I think, 741 women who've climbed out of a total of about 7,000 people who've climbed the mountain. But, you know, some extraordinary female mountaineers have climbed the mountain. Yunko Tabai from Japan, as I said, was you know, the first in 1975.
Moving on to a slightly macabre topic, but one that a lot of people are interested in, and exemplified by one of the questions from Nagayo Art, who wants to know how many people have died on Everest, and do they really use bodies as landmarks on the way up?
I think the figure is somewhere around 315 people have died on Everest. And in terms of the, you know, do they use bodies as landmarks? I think this idea of body, we know that bodies are very difficult to remove from the mountain. So, and they very quickly become stuck to the mountain because they freeze, you know, they get snowed over, and then they become almost like features in the landscape. And it takes an extraordinary effort and expense to remove bodies. So traditionally in the past, when people died, if they couldn't recover the body, they were informally disposed of. They were pushed down crevasses, or they were pushed off faces into the glacial basins below. So I think the story about bodies as waymarks has come. There was a body called Green that was referred to by the public as and climbers as Green Boots on the Northeast Ridge. The body was in a kind of small cave, sheltered rocky area, and the fixed lines used to run right over the body. So everybody had to Jumar up past, walk over the legs of the body almost. So there was an extraordinary piece of research by a BBC journalist called Rachel Newer, and she identified the body as belonging to Sawang Paljor, who was on an Indian, I think it was a police border force expedition in 1995, the one where there was the terrible storms when lots of people died. And Sawang Paljor died then, and his body remained on the mountain. You've got to remember that, you know, to recover bodies is extremely expensive. You need repatriation insurance. It might cost $80,000 to pay six or seven Sherpas to hack the body off the mountain and carry it back down the mountain. So quite often, you know, people just don't have the money to do that. So the body, you know, remains where the person died. I think a lot of bodies in 2014 on the Northeast Ridge were cleared by the Chinese Tibetan Mountaineering Association, and they were kind of removed from the ridge and placed elsewhere on the mountain. So bodies do kind of enter this kind of strange kind of persistent state at altitude. But at the same time, what we're finding at the moment is climate change. Because stuff is melting, you know, particularly in the Khumbu Icefall on the south of the mountain. Body parts are emerging that have previously been disposed of, and they're being picked up in environmental cleanup operations that Nepalese ministries run. But that creates a problem for the Nepalese authorities because it's very difficult to identify these informally disposed of human remains and to try and do the appropriate thing with them, which would be to either bury them, repatriate them. So climate change is actually kind of rapidly changing what's going on the mountain. I think increasingly now, you know, when people die, they can get helicopters up quite high onto the South Col. You know, they do try and remove bodies by helicopter, but it's not always possible. So,
moving on, this kind of leads back to what you were talking about earlier with the curious affair of the dancing llamas. But I wonder if there's more to add. There's a question: how have changing geopolitics in the course of the last couple of centuries affected the story of Everest mountaineering?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I go back to what I said first of all. I mean, Everest is situated on an international boundary, and to some extent, you know, it's a boundary object which people approach from different areas. We've been talking about the early attempts to climb Everest in the 20s and 30s, and they were all British, and they were all British for a reason, because Everest became implicated in Britain's attempt to secure its rule over British India. And certainly after the First World War, there was a real sense that British prestige, British masculinity had taken a battering, and that if they could climb Everest, they could reassert their kind of fitness to rule an empire. So it was very much kind of racial thinking. And the British had a very sophisticated control of the trans-border regions of British Empire, those mountain regions of the Himalaya, the Karakoram, the northwest frontier. And they controlled who moved through those spaces very, very effectively through surveillance. And so the British were able to really kind of reserve climbing on Everest. They kept everybody else away from Everest, every other Western European nation, you know, and wanted to keep Everest as a British project. At the same time, they were managing complex geopolitical relationships between China and Tibet. So perhaps a bit of context here. The British invaded Tibet in 1904 to try and force the Tibetans to kind of open up their country to British trade and British goods. They imposed, you know, trade agents on them, and they kind of forced Tibet into a more open relationship with its neighbour to the south. After the collapse of Qing China in 1911, you know, the British were concerned about instability in the region. After the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, you know, the British were very concerned about Soviet influences coming in across the Pamirs in the western end of the kind of Karakoram and Himalaya range. So there was constant anxiety about whether hostile powers, particularly Russia, later on Germany, could approach India through this border region. So if you look at the if you look at the Himalayas as a great arc of mountains, there's really two routes. There's probably three routes through that you could get an army through, which the British, you know, controlled very heavily. You know, one was through Afghanistan and Persia, one was up through Gilgit into Chinese Central Asia, and the other one was up through Sikkim and up into Tibet near where Everest is. So geopolitically, this region mattered to the British in India, and they monitored it very, very closely and controlled who travelled across this region. So if you go to the India Office archives in the British Library, the India Office and the Government of India kept files on all travellers who requested to travel through the region and granted them permission or refused them permission. And quite often, those requests to travel were kind of, if the British were hoping to run an Everest expedition in the next few years, they became more restrictive and allowed less people through the region because of the sensitivities of the Tibetan government. So it was a heavily kind of monitored and surveilled environment in which these expeditions operated in the early years.
Fascinating. That sort of takes us on to the last question, but why is it interesting to study the history of mountaineering on Everest? I can think of lots of reasons, but I'm sure as an expert in it, you have your own reasons. Why do you think it's interesting?
I think Everest in particular, you know, I study the history of mountaineering around the world and exploration. Everest in particular has become this kind of global signifier of so many things, and it means different things to different people. You know, I sometimes describe it as a boundary object. You know, it's a kind of massive thing which people approach from different perspectives, and quite often the different perspectives, you know, don't overlap or don't understand other perspectives, you know. So, you know, we've written histories about Everest for the last, you know, 50, 60, 70 years, which make almost no mention of, you know, indigenous high altitude workers and their extraordinary contribution to success on the mountain. You know, sometimes they're not even named. That's an extraordinary omission, you know. And as a historian, you know, who wants to write new histories of things that, you know, haven't really been addressed before, histories of things that are significant, that really matter, that's kind of that's important. That's that's one of the things that we want to do as historians, is we want to, you know, tell these hidden histories, these untold stories, and show that there are multiple perspectives. Everest is a kind of, you know, complex circus, which is constantly getting into the headlines, and trying to understand what motivates people to do what they do on Everest, you know, is actually quite interesting. And it's interesting to historicize that and understand the origins of it. You know, why do people risk their lives, pay an enormous amount of money, go through a lot of suffering sometimes when they're very ill prepared, you know, to do it? What do they think they're going to get out of climbing Everest? You know, there's a really interesting psychology around kind of aligning your own goals with this kind of global signifier of prestige and premiership. You know, it gets wrapped up into nationalist mountaineering. People, you know, want to climb the mountain to, you know, celebrate, you know, their own particular country or ethnicity. Sometimes people want to climb the mountain for personal reasons, you know, because they've been through tragedy in their own life, and somehow psychologically climbing the mountain will give them a certain amount of agency and enable them to kind of deal with challenges in their life. Or so it's a complex global phenomenon. It's tied in with globalized adventure tourism now. The mountain is suffering from kind of over-tourism and, you know, the kind of overconsumption of the commons. You know, the environment is being degraded, you know, trash is dumped there, creating all kinds of problems. You know, Western consumer lifestyles are being replicated on the mountain. Well, is that an appropriate way to climb a mountain? What's it doing to the environment? How will climate change affect the mountain? Some people are saying, 10, 15 years' time, you may not be able to climb Everest because it will be so unstable because of rapid loss of glaciers, permafrost. It's not freezing as much. You've got smaller windows to climb in. They're already talking about moving base camp further down the mountain to avoid kind of objective dangers like increasing avalanches and stuff like this. So as a historian, you know, it's really interesting to ask some questions about, you know, can history tell us something about why Everest is like it is today? You know, what kind of insights can we get from the history of Everest, and how will it help contemporary communities to adapt to the challenges they face in the region of overconsumption and climate change?
Fascinating. Lots of topical issues there. But just in terms of the motivations, I thought it, you know, you made it sound very complicated. I thought it was very simple. I thought it was just because it's there.
Well, yes. So Mallory's famous quote when he was asked by a New York journalist why he wanted to climb Mount Everest. Lots of people assume that quote is, you know, a simple statement of fact. But actually, I'm doing some research on exactly this at the moment. Mallory was notoriously, you know, didn't suffer fools gladly. And he was probably using it as a brush off for the journalist in question. But actually being there is part of a complex kind of coded language of aesthetics that Mallory used. And it actually kind of signifies something different. It is, for Mallory, being there signified a kind of coming together of kind of aesthetic and athletic and physical and mental kind of endeavor. So I think Mallory was sending a kind of coded message to those in the know about the kind of aesthetic, poetic beauty of Everest.
was Dr. Jonathan Westaway of the University of Central Lancashire. Jonathan's working on a new research project called Other Everests, which explores the overlooked aspects of the Everest mountaineering story. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.